Welcome to you all to this, the first of the World Christianity Seminars that the Divinity Faculty and the Cambridge Centre for Christianity Worldwide hold together. I'm Emma Wildwood and I'm lecturing in World Christianities whilst Joelle Cabrita, who some of you may know, is on study leave. And I'm delighted that Jesse Zink, who is the Director of the Cambridge Centre for Christianity Worldwide, is here at relatively short notice to give his paper. And just to say, if you were expecting something on women in mission, I hope you won't be too disappointed. I hope the news got out that there was a change to the programme. But Jesse, thanks very much, and over to you.
Thank you. And thank you all for being here. As Emma said, there's something of short notice about the giving of this paper, so my hope is to try out some new things and to bring together some new material and to put it out there for your consumption and hopefully your response as well. So the overarching question here that I'm interested in, I think, is basically the observation, which is not unique to me, to say that there's quite a lot of violence in the world, and that this violence often creates displacement, both within countries and abroad. So here's a chart from the UN High Commission on Refugees from their 2013 report. And you can see the number of people displaced in the world. So we now have more than at any time since World War II. And of course, this number would have only increased since this chart was put together. So on the one hand, we have violence leading to displacement. And on the other hand, we know that people have a very active social and religious life. One of the key insights of the early 21st century, I think, is that whatever people may have said and believed is that secularization is not actually happening, that people still continue to have profound religious beliefs. So I want to try and link these two things together and to ask the question about what is the connection between violence and displacement on the one hand and religious change on the other. We could ask these questions in a couple of different ways. How does religious belief and practice change in response to displacement, migration, violence? Or we could say, what is the religious life of those who are displaced like? And I think it's particularly important when we come to study displaced communities that we're attentive to gender, because it is often the case that it is women who bear the brunt of displacement, for the simple reason that it's often men who are fighting in wars and women who are left to deal with the consequences. So I want to think about these questions in relation to Sub-Saharan Africa. Sub-Saharan Africa is a vibrant and thriving place, but it is also the case that many parts of the continent have been formed by civil war in recent generations. In fact, in several contexts on the continent, violence is no longer an isolated occurrence, but has become come to have an enduring power that shapes entire generations. And it's also true that Sub-Saharan Africa is the site of a large number of refugees, or people who are displaced. That's true both of people who are externally displaced across international boundaries, and those who are displaced within their home countries but forced to leave their homes. So I want to think about all of these questions then in relation to a particular case study, and that's the case study of Sudan and its civil war that took place in the 1980s and 1990s, and particularly the Dinka people of South Sudan, who are the largest ethnic group within South Sudan. Very brief background on Sudan and its civil wars. There is a long history of violence and marginalization in Sudan that dates to the 19th century, carries through brutal British pacification campaigns that happened in the early 20th century, followed by the southern policy of the British, which restricted access to South Sudan so that outsiders were not allowed in. And then after Sudan as a whole became independent, there was a civil war between 1963 and 1972, and then a second civil war, the focus of our time here today, between 1983 and 2005. And then since December of 2013, there's been ongoing violence within South Sudan, which has led to talk of a third civil war. The second civil war, which ended in 2005, led in time to the creation, the secession of South Sudan and the creation of the new nation of South Sudan. There's many things that I could say about that. Perhaps we'll come back to them in the questions. So, like I said, I'm interested in the experience in the 1980s and the 1990s of civil war there. And a key feature of that civil war was displacement. And this displacement happened in a number of ways. Dinka people were displaced from their homes and went deeper into rural areas. So they were displaced from urban communities and went deeper into rural areas. Sometimes the opposite happened as well, and Dinka people were displaced from their home villages and forced to flee to urban areas, like Khartoum, the capital of the north, came to have a very large settlement of Dinka people. And then Dinka were displaced internationally as well, to Ethiopia, Kenya, Uganda, and eventually further afield as well. And the Second Civil War was a time of massive religious change for many Dinka people as well. At the beginning of the Civil War, it's estimated that perhaps 10% of Dinka were Christian. By the end of the Civil War, in some areas of Dinka territory, an overwhelming majority of Dinka had become Christian. And my larger research project is about exploring this religious change that took place during that time. So what I want to do in this paper, then, with this background, is to focus on the role of displaced women during the Civil War in South Sudan in the 1980s and 1990s, and consider the role of women in religious change and displacement. And I want to do that in three areas. The first area is in the leadership role that many women took on in churches in displaced communities. So how did women come to be leaders in religious communities? The second area is thinking about the church life that emerged in refugee camps and how religion came to have a shaping force for the refugee experience. And then the third area is to think about how women were involved in hymn writing and songwriting that took place during the Civil War. So those are the, so I've begun with one broad question about the relationship between displacement and religious life and religious change. I now want to ask more specific questions in relation to women, their experience of displacement during the Civil War. So let me just go give some background to the Dinka. The Dinka, as I said, are the largest ethnic group in South Sudan. There are people who call themselves Monjieng, which means the people, and they are the largest ethnic group in southern Sudan. They live in what is the Upper Nile floodplain, and I'll just see if I can point that out here. The Upper Nile floodplain is sort of this area that goes through the middle of the country, and this is outside of the floodplain, but Dinka territory continues up here. So this sort of area right here is kind of Dinka territory with some more Dinka communities farther up north here. I'll just say that, I'll show another map in a minute. Our focus is kind of in this area, right here in the middle of the country. The Dinka are historically an agro-pastoralist, semi-nomadic people whose life revolves around cattle husbandry and the seasonal movement of their cattle and themselves based on looking for water. Cattle are central to their life. They're exchanged in marriage, they're used to settle disputes, and they form the basis of social life and activity. Historically, Dinka life has centered on villages and cattle camps, where their social life and their religious ceremony is based. So here's a picture of a Dinka cattle camp around 1955 on the east bank of the Nile River. A Dinka village in the same area, also around 1955. You can see the large Luwak, which is where the cattle are kept at various times of year. And in many ways, compared to other parts of Africa, some parts of Dinka culture and Dinka territory have been relatively untouched by what we might call modernity. So think of this picture from 1955. Here's a picture I took just a little ways south of that one in 2013. And the Dinka had a strong existing religious tradition that centered on cattle and the sacrifice of animals, particularly cattle. Was centered on a single high god who is known as Nialich, the Heavenly One, but access to Nialich was mediated through a series of intermediary divinities known as Jak, J-A-K, or Yath. There's a lot of complexity there, which I'm quickly glossing over. Dinka have very little material culture. There's not in the floodplain of this area, there's not a lot of stuff to make things with. So that means that songwriting is very important, but the material culture that does exist are things like this. Sacred pegs or spears are also important. These are cattle stakes that form the basis of religious life, and also you can see how they're linked to the cattle as well, if a religious object is also a cattle peg. And this existing religion was a religion that was dominated by men and was dominated by older men. The role for women was largely marginal, although I have to say here that this is one challenge that I really have trouble in reconstructing what pre-war religious life among the Dinka was like, because there's been very little anthropological research done on the Dinka, with the exception of one famous book by a man named Godfrey Leonhardt, which all anthropologists read and makes them think that they're experts on the Dinka. But in fact, that book only answers a very narrow set of questions, and so it's very difficult to recreate what it was like. However, I think it is fair to say that in the traditional religion of the Dinka people, women had a generally marginal role. They were involved in religious ceremony, although didn't lead religious ceremony. They, for instance, would sing songs that other people composed. So the Dinka had, beginning in the early 20th century, the Dinka were encountered missionaries, primarily Anglican missionaries of the Church Missionary Society and Catholic missionaries of an Italian mission. You can see that South Sudan was divided into spheres. On the left here was the Catholic mission, and so this central area right here was the Anglican mission of CMS. And for our time together, we'll just focus on this Catholic, this Anglican area right here. The Nile River sort of goes right through there. There's Dinka on both the east banks and the west banks of it. It's probably fair to say that missionaries were generally disappointed with the success or lack thereof they were able to have among the Dinka. They very quickly started looking for other people to evangelize because they found the Dinka to be completely uninterested in what they had to say. And their letters home over the span of more than a generation are filled with despair about the religious future of the Dinka people. But one thing that the missionaries did do was they established a very close connection, as was the case in many other parts of Africa, between education and Christianity. So the basic mission approach was to educate people, because after all, how can you be a Christian if you can't read the Bible? So teach people literacy and then lead people to Christianity that way. As I said, they had very little success with that, but they did establish the connection that education and Christianity were linked, that if you were an educated person, you would also be a Christian, and vice versa. Missionaries were expelled in 1964 by the independent government of Sudan, and when they were expelled, they left behind a very small Dinka church that was composed primarily of young men who had been through mission schools and who have had to leave home. So there was a very sharp division then at the end of the mission period that was created. On the one hand, you had an urban religion that was associated with mission stations and the emerging towns in South Sudan. And the religious life of this area was predominantly Christian. On the other hand, you had a religious life that was associated with cattle camps and villages that was primarily not Christian and practiced the religion of, that we've seen, the religion of the Jack. And so there was this division, and the Dinka were very clear that it was the cattle camps and villages that was where moral authority should be, that they looked down on these urban areas that were growing because of changes that were taking place in Sudan, but the clear locus of moral approval lay in cattle camps and in villages. One thing that's true, though, is that the role for women in either of these spheres, cattle camps or in urban areas, was marginal. And in fact, because missionaries targeted young men for education, there was very little role for women at all, because in order to be Christian, you had to be literate. But if women weren't being educated, it was very difficult for them to be Christian. Many missionaries, when they started to have young Dinka Christian converts, began to write home because they were concerned that there was nobody for these young Christian converts to marry. There were no good Christian women because, in a sense, there were very few Christian women. But that was because of where the educational strategies had targeted. So that's the background that leads up to what happens in 1983 when civil war begins in South Sudan. It's a civil war that is led by the Sudan People's Liberation Army, which was the rebel army. The SPLA is led by a Dinka man named John Garang. Many of his senior lieutenants are Dinka people as well. And so the Dinka become very closely associated with the rebel movement and the opposition to the government in Sudan. I just want to pause here and go back to something I said at the beginning, which is just to think about the situation of women during times of war. War brings about substantial demographic change. Men are often involved in fighting, so they leave communities, and that creates more opportunities by their absence for leadership of women. And we've seen that, you know, when I've talked about these issues with other people, people say to me, oh, that happened during the wars around the time of the Reformation in the 17th century as well. Happened in World War II as well, I've been told. So the demographic changes create more opportunities for women, but it's also true, I think, that women can be made particularly vulnerable by warfare, because warfare, of course, is about the breakdown of political order. It's about, especially in South Sudan, it's about intense militarization. And so the people who have the guns hold the power, and it's generally not women who have the guns, by and large. So what happens during war is, I think, that it's safe to say that war can further feminize poverty, and that women in particular can become very vulnerable at these times. So I want to turn then to think about the sort of first of three areas with that background. And the first one is to think about church leadership and what happened to leadership in Christian congregations during the Civil War. And to do that, I want to focus on the kind of displacement that happened, one kind of displacement that happened during the Civil War. And I said this earlier, that because the way the Civil War was structured, the Sudan Armed Forces, which was the government army, held key garrison towns. So Juba was a key garrison town, which is the capital. Rumbek was another one. Bor was another one. But the whole hinterland areas here, the rural areas surrounding that and outside of that, were generally controlled by the SPLA, the rebel movement. But that meant that it was unsafe for Dinka people to be in these areas because of the close association with the SPLA and the Dinka. So many Dinka people, men and women, fled the cities where they were living, really towns, Juba, Bor, Rumbek, and they fled out into these rural areas where they could find safety. And what was important about this displacement is, if you remember, going back to the division I just made, that you had an urban religious life that was centered on Christianity, and you had a village and a cattle camp life that was centered not on Christianity, on the religion of the Jack. So this displacement that happened at the Civil War was basically bringing Christian Dinka, educated people, into contact in a sustained fashion with this non-Christian social landscape. And this was really the first sustained introduction of Christianity to the rural heartland of Dinka life, in the history of Dinka religious life. And what happened, and I'm going to just skip over this really quickly because I want to get to thinking about women in particular, but what happened in this religious encounter between urban Dinka and non-urban Dinka was the rapid growth of Christianity. Christianity spread through individual preaching centers, in which healing prayer and hymn singing and preaching were pronounced. It became the case that churchgoers began to believe that God was favoring Christians by performing miracles that protected them during the Civil War. There were many stories of how Christian communities were believed to be protected during times of violence. But it also lowered the barriers to entry. If before you had to be literate to be Anglican Christian, now the discipline of literacy almost entirely vanished. People turned to Christianity in large numbers. So here's a picture of a Christian worshiping community. You can see this. This is happening in a cattle camp, obviously, outside of Rumbek during the Civil War. And so all of a sudden, Christianity begins to grow in these urban areas, in these non-urban areas, and it's really because of the displacement that has happened from urban areas to non-urban areas. And what's important is that women took a key role in these emerging churches for many reasons. The church was providing new opportunities for women to socialize in these preaching centers, and women began to lead prayers in religious services, which was not something that they could have done earlier. And especially key to this religious change was that it was women who were in socially marginal positions who were finding Christianity particularly appealing. So one woman who found Christianity particularly appealing was this woman, Mary R.Y. Majak. This picture is from about 2 years old, so imagine her 30 years younger. During the Civil War. Mary R.Y. comes from perhaps the most marginal position in Dinka society of all, which is to say that she was never married, and so she was childless. And it came to happen that she was living, before the Civil War, she was living in Rumbek, an urban area, a town, and she was not a Christian, but she heard about what happened in the very small Dinka church there. And what had happened was that there was a woman like her, childless, who died, and that creates problems because you need your family to bury you, but if you have no children, you can't be buried. And so what the Anglican pastor, priest in charge of that congregation said to his congregation was, this woman has passed away, she is part of our family, it is our job to bury her. And so they laid her to rest in the way that was customary. And news of this got around because it was so unusual, and Mary R.Y. heard about this. And she said, I want to become part of that as well. And so she became a Christian around the beginning of the Civil War. She was using Christianity to address the weakness of her socially marginal position. And there are many cases in which this has happened elsewhere in Africa. There's a lengthy study of Christianity among Maasai women in Tanzania and Kenya by a woman named Dorothy Hodgins. And she talks, and the Maasai are similar people, agropastoralists, cattle keepers in East Africa. Dorothy Hodgins says about the Maasai that Christianity, quote, enabled Maasai women to create an alternative female community beyond the control of Maasai men. Women were interested in coming together to learn, to pray, to talk to one another. It was the spirit, not the structure of the church that appealed to them. And I think that that's what was happening among Dinka women as well. But it wasn't just that Dinka women were becoming Christian and becoming part of these existing religious communities. They were also becoming evangelists and leaders in the Christian community. And Mary R.Y. is a key figure in that. So she becomes Christian around the beginning of the Civil War. And then the Civil War begins, and she's forced to leave Rumbek, this town where she lives, and go back to her home village. And there she became an effective evangelist. She began to tell other people about what she'd learned. She began to start these preaching centers that took place under trees. And she encountered opposition. She told me, this woman who's never given birth to any child, she's now trying to misuse our woman. She might come with some unique faith, which is against our tradition. And it is said, in fact, it's documented, that Mary R.Y.'s evangelism in her home region led to the creation of 23 new congregations. And it's true that she worked with men, with other young men, and with other women, but that she was the motive force behind a lot of what was happening. And again, it's because of this displacement that happened from urban areas to rural areas. And there were many other women like her. She just happens to be an exceptional example. And the key point is that from a socially marginal position, women were able to find social status in the midst of civil war through the church. And there's actually statistics that exist on this. So 1991, the middle of the Civil War, although they didn't know it was the middle then, there was an Anglican diocese on the east bank of the river, of the Nile River. And it reported on the number of clergy and religious leaders that they had. So you can see in 1991, this diocese had 62 male clergy, which is a huge number compared to at the beginning of the Civil War, there were 10 Dinka clergy in this diocese. So you can see the kind of religious growth that is happening. And they had 72 male evangelists. But they also had 30 Mothers Union staff and 101 women workers with badges, which essentially means commissioned lay women of the sort like Mary R.Y. And in one area, Duke Faiwil, which is a little ways north along the river, but right in this Dinka territory, this was one parish, and it had 15 sub-parishes. And in those 15 sub-parishes, there was one priest, who was a man, three deacons, five evangelists, all men, but nine women in leadership. On the west bank, of the Nile River, also in what was formerly the Anglican sphere, there's a 1992 report which lists 200 congregations, and women's names feature prominently in them. In the Akot area, which is a town in that area around there, there two of the five parishes were led by women, and 11 of the 25 sub-parishes were led by women as well. In Maper, which is the area that Mary R.Y. was from, there were two of six parishes led by women and four of 19 sub-parishes were led by women as well. And I just want to underline, clearly these statistics do not show gender parity, and women could not be ordained to the priesthood in the Anglican Church in South Sudan until the early 2000s. But there's a very sharp contrast to be drawn here between pre-war religious life and religious life during the war. Another one of these women evangelists is this woman, Martha Kwe Marier, and she says, God says people are equal, whether men or women, they are all equal in the Lord, and we are free in the church. We can even stand in front of the people and talk about the kingdom of God. But in the Jeng community tradition, that is the Dinka tradition, women are not allowed to stand, even when there is a family discussion. And there was opposition, clearly, to the social change that was taking place during the Civil War. Many older men who were around were worried that the church was corrupting younger women. There are stories of young women being prevented from going to church. And clearly, there's a lot of complexity to the social change that is taking place at this time. It also happens that many men were fighting the war, so they weren't around. But I think the key point I want to underline here is the way in which the displacement that took place during the Civil War from urban areas to non-urban areas led to religious change, and that in many ways women were among the first to be exposed to that religious change and to take part in that religious change, and that they were then able to use Christianity to challenge previously marginalized positions in society. So I want to change gears here and move from thinking about religious life within Dinka areas in southern Sudan. So there, again, this map, there's Bor and Rumbek, these areas that we're talking about right in the middle of the country, because there's also very large streams of displacement that took place not only within southern Sudan, as we've just seen, but outside, across international borders as well. And it's actually, definitionally, according to international law, it's only when you actually cross an international border that you become a refugee. So this is actually the religious life of refugees part here, according to the title. And the basic movement was something like this. From areas on the east bank of the Nile River here, but also from farther up this way as well, hundreds of thousands of Dinka were, in the early years of the war, displaced to a series of refugee camps in Ethiopia. So Itang, Pinyindo, Dima. Then in 1991, which I'll talk about in a minute, the course of the war changed, and many were sent back to Sudan, and then found new refugee camps. One was in Kakuma in northern Kenya. There were also camps in the border of Uganda and right along, right around Nimuli here within South Sudan, but right on the border with Uganda. Those of you who may have encountered Sudanese in the past may be familiar with the story of the Lost Boys of Sudan, as they're called. This is particularly true outside of England, in places like the US and Canada, which in time resettled many of these refugees. Not many, actually, a very small percentage of these refugees from places like Kakuma. And so many Sudanese, especially in North America and Australia, tend to be Dinka, who can tell a familiar story, familiar to me at any rate, of going first to Ethiopia, then to Kakuma, and then being resettled. settled from there. So, what can we say about the religious life that took place in these refugee camps? Well, the first thing is we want to talk about the social life in these camps, and to begin in Ethiopia, in this archipelago of camps that we have there. So this was the 1980s, the late 1980s. It was a very difficult time to be a refugee in a place that was very difficult to access. It was the end of the Cold War, so there was very little attention being paid to this part of the world. There had just been a famine in Ethiopia in 1984 and later years, so essentially people's attention for this part of the world had already been exhausted. Aid agencies had tremendous problems getting relief supplies to the area. And more importantly, the SPLA, the rebel army, was allied with the Ethiopian government, and the Ethiopian government was allowing them to use southwestern Ethiopia as their staging ground. So essentially, the SPLA had a key role in controlling the camps. They took the relief aid, they conscripted people for military service, and it was generally a difficult place to be. But there was, it was also a period in which there was a growing church. And I explore this in much greater detail in other places, but I'll just say now that in these refugee camps in Ethiopia, there was significant amounts of religious change taking place as well. And similar to what was going on at the same time within southern Sudan, many people were becoming Christian. The churches were emerging as alternate centers of social life on a very small scale, in relation to the SPLA control of these refugee camps. And the key thing that was going on in these emerging churches in Ethiopia was that women again took